person, tam, him, aham, I, pajami, worship. Translation, lowest of all is located Devi Dhamma, mundane world. Next above it is Mahesha Dhamma, abode of Mahesh. Above Mahesha Dhamma is placed Hari Dhamma, abode of Hari. And above them all is located Krishna's own realm named Goloka. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, who has allotted their respective authorities to the rulers of those graded realms. Purport by His Divine Grace Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Thakur. The realm of Goloka stands highest above all others. Brahma, looking up to the higher position of Goloka, is speaking of the other realms from the point of view of his own realm. The first in order is this mundane world called Devi Dhamma, consisting of the 14 worlds, namely Satyaloka, etc. Next above Devi Dhamma is located Shiva Dhamma, one portion of which, called Mahakala Dhamma, is enveloped in darkness. Interpenetrating this portion of Shiva Dhamma, there shines the Sada Shiva Loka, full of great light. Above the same appears Hari Dhamma, or the transcendental Vaikuntha Loka. The potency of Devi Dhamma, in the form of the extension of Maya, and that of Shiva Loka, consisting of time, space, and matter, are the potency of the separated particles pervaded by the penumbral reflection of the subjective portion of the divinity. But Hari Dhamma is ever resplendent with transcendental majesty, and the great splendor of all sweetness predominates over all other majesties in Goloka. The Supreme Lord Govinda, by his own direct and indirect power, has constituted those respective potencies of those realms. Wow, that's a lot. So, Bhaktisiddhanta is showing us here that Lord Brahma in the Brahma Samhita, he's speaking from his own position in the material world, looking up to Goloka. He's meditating on Krishna for a long time, and he becomes acquainted with the expanse of the ocean of truth, and then he begins this hymn, looking up at the highest pinnacle of creation of the world, which is the very sweet realm of Goloka. So the first realm is Devi Dham, which is the abode of Durga. That is the material energy wherein people are this jivas are engaged in material activities in ignorance. And it's a place of darkness without the illumination coming from the sun. It's all dark. Then the next abode up is Shiva Dhamma, and we hear in this purport, we hear that it's divided into two portions. One portion is enveloped in darkness, but interpenetrating, there is the Sadashiva Loka, full of great light. And the potency of Devi Dhamma in the form of the extension of Maya and that of Shiva Loka, consisting of time, space, and matter, are the potency of the separated particles pervaded by the penumbral reflection of the subjective portion of the divinity. Wow, I could study that sentence and try to parse it and figure it out for a long time. Penumbral, of course, refers to the like a shadow. But in this case, penumbral reflection, like dawn, there's a shadow of light when you, like if you shine, like in an eclipse, if you shine, if you get the moon behind the sun, then there's different. There's a portion where the sun is actually shining, and then there's a portion where there's light that's just a shadow of light, a reflection, a dim reflection of light. In the dawn, they say that when the sun starts to come up, we're not actually seeing directly the rays of the sun itself, but it's being bent through refraction through the atmosphere. Who knows Snell's law? Anyway... You guys haven't studied optics, huh? The sine of the angle of refraction over the cosine of the angle of incidence is... Yeah, I forget it, too. But anyway, that's a penumbra. So there's a lot of optical metaphors in this or explanations based on the science of optics, the pencil of the ray of light of Vishnu. You know, these are all words that come from physics that Bhaktisiddhanta is using. He was a scientist and an astronomer, and he was familiar with all these terms. He's translating. Shubhananda tells us in the beginning that this is his commentary closely follows that of Bhaktivinod Thakur. But Bhaktivinod's was in Bengali, I think. And so his is in English. But anyway, this description of Shiva Loka and the two parts of it and how the potency of Devi Dhamma and Shiva Loka are the potency of the separated particles pervaded by the penumbral reflection. The penumbral reflection of the subjective portion of divinity is Shambhu, right? Is Shiva we were discussing before. That's a difficult sentence for me. The Haridhamma is the Vaikuntha planets, and they're resplendent with transcendental majesty. They're the perfected yogis who are able to constantly meditate on Krishna, and they attain Krishna, and they go and live in his own planet, and they're aware that they're in the presence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in all his majesty. And there's fabulous wealth there and unlimited wealth and unlimited opulence. His power and majesty is reflected there, displayed there in those planets. And there's those unlimited planets with the different names that Lord Chaitanya describes in the Chaitanya Charitamrita and the teachings to Sanatana Goswami. The various different expansions of Vishnu that exist and their relationship to different pastimes, also different holy places, and there's 24 of them that he describes, but there's with different combinations of conch shell and club and lotus and chakra. And so if you take four things and you want to arrange them in all the different permutations, I think it's 4 factorial, right? It comes out to 24. 4 times 3 times 2. So there's 24 different combinations of conch shell and club and so forth. So that Haridhamma is the Vaikuntha Loka, which is completely spiritual. And it's completely illuminated there. There's no darkness there. There's no need for illumination. Yet, na tadbhasayate suryo na shashanko na pavakaha. Yad gatva na nivartante. Anyone who attains there never comes back. Tad dhamma paramang mama. That's Krishna's supreme abode. But above that, and this is the point, he's praising Krishna Govinda, whose abode of Goloka is above the majestic, opulent abode of Vaikuntha. Here it's explained. It's not that opulence doesn't exist in Goloka, but it's covered by a greater opulence of sweetness. The great splendor of all sweetness predominates over all other majesties in Goloka. So that sweetness, in that sweetness, arranged by Yoga Maya, the devotees do not. This seems to be a theme that we've been discussing the last few weeks. The devotees do not consider Krishna to be God. They keep thinking he's killing this demon or something, and then they think somehow by providence he was saved. The demon was killed in his pastimes on earth. Madhya Yashoda, they pray to Narayan and to protect him. And sometimes they think, oh, maybe he's supernatural somehow. But but they don't know that he's the source of everything and that everything comes from him. That would interfere with their mood of love. And yet, they know him better than anyone else. And that Govinda, who's known that way, he's the source of all these other realms. That's what Lord Brahma is expressing here, that realm of Goloka is actually higher than the majestic realm of Vaikuntha, that realm of Goloka where the opulence is yogurt and flowers and cows. It's not emeralds and pearls. Of course, there's all pearls there, all diamonds and everything. But the special sweetness there covers that, that it appears as a rural country place rather than a big palace with jeweled pillars and jeweled ceilings and walls and things. The jewels are everywhere, right? What is Srinivasacharya saying? That Nana Ratna Nibadhamula Vitapa Sri Yukta Vrindavane, all the roots of all the desire trees are covered by all valuable gems in that land. But it's a land where the majestic opulence of Krishna as God would interfere with the intimate sweetness of the loving exchanges that are exchanged with the devotees there. And Lord Brahma is telling us that's the highest, that's where God displays his most complete, he displays himself with most, his complete potencies in there, where his potency of that love that's not interfered with by fear, by awe and reverence. So that's the highest planet of all. The Goloka planet, it's not very often described in many Vedic literatures. And this Brahma Samhita is one of the literatures in which it's described. This verse is a very special verse in that this verse actually is saying, you know, point blank, right out very explicitly, that there's these different realms, and above Haridhamma is located this Goloka Dhamma, which of course is being described throughout the Brahma Samhita from the very beginning of the Brahma Samhita. He talks the second verse. Gokulakyam, the super excellent station of Krishna known as Gokula. He's describing Gokula or Goloka throughout the throughout this chapter, this one chapter that we have.
Lord Krishna, when he appears on earth, the people of Vrindavana, they do not consider him, they do not know him as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But what about those who are actually living in the real Golok? Do they have full knowledge that he is the Personality of Godhead, but yet, you know, treat him as one of their friends or sakis or something like that?
Well, I'm just, my own understanding is no, they don't. That what he's displaying when he comes to earth and he displays the mood of the loving exchanges with the Brijbasis is that he's actually bringing his highest... Hare Krishna, good to see you. He's bringing his highest, that highest pastimes from the highest part of the spiritual world to earth and displaying that. And that's not often displayed. When he comes as Vishnu in so many times, Vraha, Nisringa, and he displays his majestic opulence and he kills different demons as Prishnigarbha and as Vamana and, you know, the different... We were talking about the 24. So there's different avatars. Anyway, I don't remember. It gets very technical that there are Vaibhava Prakashas and... Lila Prakashas and Lord Chaitanya explains all this stuff. But when he appears as Krishna, he appears in his full majesty. And that full majesty is really only displayed in Vrindavan. When he goes to Mathura, when he goes to Dwarka, even though he's Krishna, he doesn't display that same sweetness. The Yadus in Dwarka, they see him as the personality of Godhead. When he came to the wrestler's arena in Mathura and was there to kill Kamsa, the different people saw him in 10 different ways. Some saw him with four arms and some saw him as death personified and so forth. But the Brijbasis, their knowledge of him as God is submerged under the sweetness of their intimate relationship with him. And that intimate relationship with him is a higher display of his potency, a higher display of his qualities. More of his qualities are displayed there than anywhere else that it contains. Just like in this, the Sankhis, right, who describe material science, they explain that, you know, in as we move from subtle to gross, the elements contain more features. Water contains more features than air. It can be tasted as well as felt and seen. You know, and earth contains more features as, than water, that it can also has fragrance. It has fragrance and taste and touch and all those senses. So in that way, the world expands from subtle to gross in the material world. In the spiritual world, as we progress through different realms of in Haridhamma and stuff, these Krishna displays more opulences. And in Goloka, where he displays the sweetness of his intimate loving pastimes with those who are not not mitigated, interfered with by awe and reverence, that sweetness of the love that Mother Yashoda has for him when she feels she has to punish him, that contains all the other rasas. That's how it's explained by the Goswamis. It's explained in terms of rasas. They use the language of classical theater, you know, the different moods, or rasas are translated by Bhaktisiddhanta as mellows that are relished by devotees. That they're just translated as mellows. So in the mood of Mother Yashoda, the mellows of servitorship and neutrality and fraternal affection are also contained, but also something else is added, this sense of having to protect the Lord, a kind of love in which you want, in which you feel parental affection, in which you feel like you have to, that you're superior, you're loving a child, your child, is it contains all those moods and more. And the mood of so these things are discussed, we understand, by the six Goswamis, this analysis of these different rasas. And there's controversies and details and discussions about the conclusion in our sampradaya is that the parakīya rasa, the love of paramour love, the illegal love of the gopis who are running to Krishna in the night, escaping from their husbands and from their homes and stuff. This, although it appears, if someone misunderstands it, it would appear as that we're you know, exalting some abominable irreligious thing. But actually, this is a mood of love of God that is displayed, that contains more than any other mood. It contains all of the moods. So the six Goswamis are glorifying that. And Krishna shows, a lot of people ask, why does Krishna show that? Why do you worship a God who's immoral? He has too many wives, or even he has girlfriends that he's not married to. And what kind of example is that? Does that mean that the devotees of Krishna are immoral people, that they believe in illicit sex or something like that? And actually, no, but Krishna displays those things. Krishna does show an example of being a pious king, and, you know, he gives away cows in charity every morning. He does all these things. But he displays these moods of love of the gopis, of parakīya bhava, because that really is the highest expression of love of God. It's the greatest love. It's the most complete love, and the gopis give themselves more completely to Krishna than, you know, than even the perfect devotees in Vaikuntha. And so that is expanded upon and explored in all of the literature of the six Goswamis, like the Brihat Bhagavatamrita. If you haven't read that Brihat Bhagavatamrita, the BBT 3-volume edition, it's a big book, but it's a really wonderful book in which, you know, Sanatan Goswami lays this out very clearly. That, you know, how he compares the devotion of, not just he's comparing, but Jamadagni is hearing from I forget who, Jaimini Rishi, one of the, you know, so there are different dialogues going on in there, just like in the Bhagavatam. So it's, but he's showing this is the, what happened was that King Parikshit's mother, Uttara, we were just reading about how when he was in her womb, she prayed and Krishna protected him. So when he had been cursed by Sringi and he had to die in 7 days, he was there hearing Srimad Bhagavatam for 7 days from Shukadeva Goswami. But his mother couldn't get close. All there were sannyasis and sages and things all around, and she couldn't hear very clearly. You know, they didn't have the microphone system. And so she couldn't hear exactly what was said. So then after the Bhagavatam was concluded, the 12th canto was concluded, and Parikshit Maharaj was ready to meet the snake bird's bite, his mother was able to come up to him and say, I couldn't hear what, you know, could you please summarize for me what was said? And then he told her this Bhagavatamrita. And in that Bhagavatamrita, there's two books, two parts, and they complement one another. And one is Narada Muni is going to look for the devotee who's the greatest recipient of the Lord's mercy. And he gets sent from one devotee to another devotee to another devotee, from a king in South India, or from a Brahmin somewhere to a king in South India, to a, you know, to Indra, to Shiva, to, you know, to Lord Brahma, to Lord Shiva, to, you know, Prahlad Maharaj and Hanuman and the Pandavas, and, you know, all these, from one devotee. And each time he sees one devotee, he praises all the qualities of their devotional service. And then they very humbly explain the faults of, you know, why some other devotee's devotional service has better qualities and how theirs has some faults. And in this way, one after another, he progresses up to the Yadu dynasty into Uddhava. And then Uddhava explains that the gopis, that they have the greatest mercy. And then there's a conclusion at that point in Dwarka that it just so happens that Narada Muni comes to Dwarka at a time when Krishna is overwhelmed with homesickness for Vrindavan and this real great mood of how he's feeling like he needs to see the gopis and he's betrayed them and he's, you know. So anyway, this literature of the six Goswamis explains in great detail the science of this different moods of how people love God. And, you know, throughout the world of religion and things, people love God in different ways. But generally, they love God as the Father, the Creator, the supplier of things. They pray to God to supply their necessities. And this is a way, this is pious, right? Krishna says, pious men approach me when they're in need, when they desire things, when they're distressed. This is one way to approach God. But if you really want to understand fully the love of God, then the Srimad Bhagavatam explains that, and the Brihad Bhagavatamrita explains and analyzes the different kinds of love. And might be surprising to some people that the highest, most full expression of God's love for his devotees and the devotees' love for God is these girls in a rural village who don't know him as God and who forsake all the rules of morality and society and to run to him because of their intense affection. And that's Lord Brahma is seeing that realm where the people forget about him being God and they love him with a greater intimacy and sweetness is the higher realm than when they know him to be God and they serve him in opulence and majesty. It's a greater majesty. It's a sweetness that covers the majesty with a greater, defeats the majesty of Vaikuntha with that sweetness.
Just one more question. You mentioned that Yogamaya covers the souls who are living in Golok. Does Yogamaya also cover the people of the Vaikuntha
Yes, the word Yogamaya. We actually, when I was in New Dwarka for, I think it was for Rath Yatra, Vaisheshika was reading Srimad Bhagavatam, and Vaisheshika, he's always reading, he's always the nectar hound, and it's become more and more famous. And now, instead of just one or two devotees sitting around reading with him, it's, you know, people all say, Vaisheshika's in the garden reading or something like that. You have to climb over this wall to get to this garden. And there was like eight of us and stuff. There was this devotee, now I forget his name, from Mayapur. There were some nice devotees there. And this discussion came up because I think that there are different kinds of yoga maya. And she, you know, expresses herself in different ways. So the kind of yoga maya that expresses herself in Vrindavan by covering his sweetness is different yoga maya. But the position that I was taking, and some devotees, Vijay, the book distributor Vijay, and some others were disagreeing with me, and we'd never resolve it. But then I found a verse that I later sent an email to Vaishya about it. But basically, my position was that the jivas, being infinitesimal, you know, always have to be under the control of Krishna's energy. And they're either under the control of his illusory energy or they're under the control of his internal energy. And sometimes Prabhupada refers to that internal energy as yoga maya. The jivas that are in sayujya and believing themselves to have become one with God, identical with God, and extinguish their identity, are in mahamaya. They're not under the three modes of material nature, but they're in the last snare of maya, where they're still not clear about their real identity. But the jivas that are pure devotees that are worshipping Krishna. And the Shanta Rasa is kind of on the borderline between, sometimes Lord Chaitanya doesn't describe it. I mean, like great devotees like Prahlad Maharaj are described as being in the Shanta Rasa. But in the Shanta Rasa, there's not a lot of activity and exchange. It's very neutral and contemplating, like the yogis who meditate on Paramatma. It's very passive there. So it's hardly full, but that's also to be engaged in Krishna's service. You have to be engaged by his internal energy, who engages you in service. But the quality of his internal energy that engages the devotees in Vrindavan is of a special quality. So exactly who these characters are, Tulsi Devi, you know, Vrinda Devi, and Purnamasi, the kind of the guru of Vrindavan, this elderly Brahmin lady, Madhu Mangala's grandmother, and then Radharani herself, who's the Ladini Shakti, the pleasure potency, the bliss. Anyway, these are internal potencies of Krishna that direct the pastimes of how things go on in Vrindavan, in a different way from how they go on in Vaikuntha. But the jiva always has to be under the control of Krishna's energy. So if the jiva is not under the control of internal energy, then they're under the control of external energy. They take shelter, like Bhagavad Gita says, Mahatmanastumang Partha Diving Prakriti Mashrita. So they're taking shelter of the Daivi Prakriti, which is Krishna's internal energy. So that sometimes Prabhupada refers to that internal energy as yoga maya. And the part that Vijaya and some of the other devotees were taking in the discussion with Vaisheshika were that, you know, there's a special yoga maya in Vrindavan. So they were saying, and the devotees in Vaikuntha who know him, as who understand that he's God, are not under yoga maya, because they were thinking of that particular yoga maya of Vrindavan.
Internal energy is also referred to Radharani in many contexts. So does it imply that Radharani, yoga maya is Radharani or it's an expansion of that in some potency?
Yeah, Radharani is the... Radharani is the original, the highest of the... There's all the all of Krishna's conjugal consorts or wives, the queens and so forth, are personifications of his internal energies. So they're not jivas, they're not small like us. In some sampradayas, they're described as jivas. And that is that, you know, Krishna appears, or rather Vishnu appears, like Lakshmi appears as the consort of Vishnu when he's the guna avatar, who's, you know, the quality of the mode of goodness and stuff. So she appears in a form like that of it, but actually of a demigoddess. But actually, she's internal potency, and so she's the predominating. The way, anyway, this is pretty technical stuff. But the way Bhaktisiddhanta describes it in Sri Brahma Samhita is that she's the predominated moiety, or that is, she's the, you know, like the, we talk about the indwelling, predominated, and predominating aspect of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That God is both male and female, and that his female aspect is his energy, his Shakti, and the male aspect is the Shaktiman, or the controller of the energy, and that they're one, but they're eternally divided into these two aspects to enjoy, to perform pastimes with each other. And so the different gopis and the different queens and the different Lakshmis are all expansions of the, and just like, you know, Narayan or, you know, Yadava, Krishna in Dwarka is an expansion of the original Govinda, who's being described as, you know, as the highest pinnacle of God. That it's the same God, but he's displaying different potencies in different manifestations. And similarly, all of those internal potencies, the female, you know, Shaktis of the Lord, are expansions of Radharani, and she displays her most complete manifestation as Radhika in Vrindavan, but Lakshmi is an expansion of Radhika. So she's the chit potency that we're describing here. But there's more details that, you know, in exactly how, you know, the different roles that these different expansions of internal energy play in Krishna's Leela and things, and who exactly they are. But they're all expansions of Radha, just like all the Vishnus are expansions of Krishna.
Thank you, Prabhupada.
Jai.